WLNNE.org. I'm Rick Ganley. This is NHPR News.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. The floodwaters have long receded in the Upper Valley city of Lebanon, but the problems have not. Lebanon was especially hard hit during the heavy rains we saw early in the summer, with an intense downpour on July 2nd that caused huge damage. This week, another community meeting will be held with those most affected. City officials and residents will be looking at new designs for roads, bridges, buildings, ditches, and culverts as they work to adapt to what many now call the new normal of more frequent and more damaging floods. It's a conversation happening around the state. With heavy rainstorms becoming more common, communities are trying to improve their infrastructure, from higher bridges over rivers and streams to wider culverts underneath, to roads built to withstand rushing waters. Today in The Exchange, facing the floods of the future, we'll look at how we're preparing and what needs to be done before the next big rain. Let's hear from you. Have you lived in a community that has experienced major flooding over the past decade? How was your town unprepared for the floods? Did any positive changes come out of the flood after the fact? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange. We have two guests with us, Jennifer Jacobs, professor of civil engineering at UNH with a specialty in water. She's also the director of the Infrastructure and Climate Network. And Jennifer, it's really nice to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here this morning.
Also with us, Sherry Godlewski, Environmental Program Manager for the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. And Sherry, welcome and thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me, Laura. Great to be here.
Well, before we get into all the infrastructure changes and the way communities are having to revamp and rebuild, Jennifer, just to you first, how much more rain are we really seeing? Is it more? Does it just seem to be more?
Well, we are seeing more rain, particularly if we cut the state almost halfway, where we slice from Gorham all the way down to the Keene area. On the lower east side, what we're seeing is almost a doubling in some of our extreme events. There's a number of different studies out there, and essentially what they're saying is we've got about a 75% increase in extreme rainfall events. So recent history has shown us that we are seeing increased rainfall, increased extreme events.
75% increase in extreme rainfall events, Jennifer. Is that just to say in southwestern New Hampshire or south of Gorham?
That's if you start at the seacoast and move northwest, the most intense increases have happened in the seacoast area. So Durham, Portsmouth, in that area. And then as you start moving to the northwest, the increases are a little bit lower, but certainly the floods haven't been limited to that area. We've seen floods in the White Mountain regions. We've seen floods certainly up in the Dartmouth, over in the Keene region. So really no part of the state has been immune to these really large rainfall events.
Yeah, and later on we'll talk to somebody from Lebanon, which got super hard hit just around the 4th of July. To you too, I think, Sherry, what are you seeing? Your thoughts, what you've observed?
Exactly what Jennifer has said. We're seeing more frequent precipitation and more rain falling at these events. So it's just something our infrastructure isn't used to.
Is the problem, Sherry, that the ground gets saturated and then it just can't take anymore? Or is the problem that all of a sudden there's this huge dump?
Both. The ground does get saturated and it can't take anymore. And then when we're having these extreme events, there's more rain falling in less amount of time. Plus, it's important to note that our land use has changed significantly in the state. We've seen a lot more development, changing from forested lands and agriculture to neighborhoods with paved driveways and roofs and all that impervious surface, we call it, surfaces that can't absorb water, cause an increase in runoff.
So 100 years ago, if they got a heavy rain, there was more forest land, there was more farmland, so the ground would absorb it more easily. So maybe it wouldn't be as big a deal, even if they got the same amount of rainfall. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, and also our population has increased, so we have more people living in these flood-prone areas. So not only are we having more runoff, we have more people impacted by these floods.
Right. Can you give us your thoughts on that as well, Jennifer? It's not just the amount of rain, but it's how we've restructured the landscape.
I think it's a combination of those, as Sherry said. The We have about 16,000 miles of rivers and streams in this state. And we have almost the same number of places where the road crosses the streams, as well as additional places where there's culverts. And so we're really seeing an intersection between people and environment. And we certainly had huge rainfall events. The hurricanes back in the 30s were just devastating to this region. And we built some dams. We put some control structures into place. So we don't really have the floods that we had in some of those regions. But now we are seeing the increased precipitation, more land development. And so when you talk about flooding, you really have to talk about those two in combination. What's happening with the rainfall? What's happening with the landscape? And the result is that we're seeing an overall intersection of the weather and the people, and there's more destruction in the roads. There's more catastrophic failures of roadways, and it's really challenging our infrastructure.
One more question about this interplay between, it's not just the amount of water we get, but it's how we've changed the landscape. And I have to ask you this, Jennifer, because not only are you a civil engineer, but you're a director of this group, the Infrastructure and Climate Network. How much resistance is there among traditional civil engineers to use these newer, what are called pervious pavements, pavements that act more like the natural ground, soaking up rain, so that we don't have these extreme problems with floods?
Well, UNH has a phenomenal stormwater center. It's not my center. It's Dr. Tom Ballesteros' center. The use of pervious pavement has, I would say, not taken off entirely. It has been used in a number of parking lots and really with roaring success. There's a new Target over in Stratham that has half a parking lot that is the regular pavement, the other half that's pervious. And if you're over there in a rainstorm, the difference is absolutely night and day. The challenge to...
What is it like?
The standard pavement, it's just water running off the surface.
Puddles.
And you can just see, you know, sort of a stream of water. And the part that's pervious, it looks just like a soil. It's gone in, it's dry, so the surface isn't wet.
Does it get spongy when you walk on it, like dirt would?
No. It's a different in the pavement mix where you have what they call less of the fines, so you've got some room for the water to be able to move through. It's kind of like the difference between a clay soil, where you would expect water to pond on it, and a sand at the beach. So it's able to soak up the water and then bring it back through the system.
But there's been some resistance, right, to putting this on roads. People are fearful that it might not be safe.
Well, I think there's less of a safety concern and more there's a maintenance concern on it. And any time that you're talking about changing infrastructure, whether it's bridges or roads, you're talking about a long-term investment. So you're putting something down that you want to work for 20, 30, 100 years. And so just changing because we have some experimental data, the industry's not going to do that. We need to have real strong evidence that this is going to work, largely because we're talking about public safety. We're talking about a large investment of public dollars. And so we want to be comfortable that this is going to work.
1-800-892-6477 is our number here in the Exchange. Join us as we look at the increase in floods we've seen, not just in other parts of the country like Colorado, which made major headlines earlier this month, but also here in New Hampshire. Join us, 1-800-892-6477, with your questions, comments, personal experiences with this issue of more and more major floods. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And Sherry, to you, just a little bit more on, both of you described how we're seeing more of these longer lasting, more intense. You know, we used to call these 100-year floods. That was how we measured them, that they're so big, they only happen once every 100 years. Then in the mid-2000s, we had a couple 100-year floods, didn't we, in New Hampshire? So maybe we need a new terminology here.
Well, what the research shows us is that the old 100-year flood, which is a flood that has a 1% chance of happening in a year, is going to have to be changed. Like you mentioned in your opening remarks, Laura, it's a new normal out there. With these increased precipitation events, the 100-year flood has we had three of them in 2 years, you know, in 2006 through 2007, and it was pretty significant. And so I think that as we work with communities to help them understand what they can plan for, we have to bring that up, that the old 100-year flood is not only a 1% chance anymore. That is changing now.
Maybe we need to change the name of it then if it's not going to happen.
That's, you know, a good idea.
Because once in 100 years you think, okay, I don't need to worry about that.
So. Right. You get through one and you go, phew, I'm all set.
Right.
Yeah. So, but yeah, I think the terminology is changing.
Can you talk a little bit more, please, Sherry, about the link between these floods that we're seeing, not just here but in other parts of the country, and climate change? Because I think when the research started to come out, you know, 20 years ago, people thought, climate change, okay, it's going to be hotter. But this is not necessarily hotter. It's just wetter and more troublesome.
Right. Well, when we have a buildup of CO2, carbon dioxide, in our atmosphere, that traps heat. And when heat is trapped, it also does do what you mentioned in terms of making hotter days and hotter summers, but it also changes the hydrology, or the way the water moves through the system. And so as we warm our planet, there's going to be more frequent rain events like we're seeing here, more drought in the central part of the state, although poor Colorado had both drought and flooding within the same year. So it does. It changes the water cycle, and those dynamics shift everything from the Gulf Stream to how our precipitation moves through and condensation in the clouds, et cetera. So, yes, people did think it was global warming, but now we think as the globe warms, it also changes our precipitation patterns.
I'd love to hear from you, too, on that, Jennifer.
Right. So what is being called for in the latest round of IPCC projections is
that's the International Panel on Climate Change something.
That's,
I'm missing
said,
the last C
what,
there. Yeah,
that's why I said it really fast. Right, it's the International Panel that's working on the large-scale global climate predictions. And what they're seeing for this region of the country is that there are modest amounts overall in increases in precipitation. So maybe a 10 to 15% increase in precipitation, and different models will have different ranges, but that's, they're projecting an upward total amount of precipitation. But what they're also saying is that the delivery of that precipitation is going to occur slightly differently. And that is, there are storms, we can expect larger, more intense storms, which means that we'll probably have some extra time in between storms. And some of the storms are going to be really quite extreme. So we'll have higher extremes than what we've seen in the past.
And it'll be harder for the surrounding environment to absorb them because they'll be so big.
Right.
We will talk a lot more after a short break. We'll start taking your calls, too. Join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send us a short email, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. We'll be right back.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. And this week, Writers on a New England Stage welcomes Pulitzer Prize winner A. Scott Berg. He'll be reading from his biography of President Woodrow Wilson, then speak with NHPR's Virginia Prescott about his writing process. Join us at the Music Hall in Portsmouth on September 26. Tickets and information are at nhpr.org. Writers on a New England Stage is a partnership between New Hampshire Public Radio and the Music Hall. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from UNH Professional Development and Training, with one-day seminars in business, teaching, social work, computers, and more in Portsmouth, Manchester, and Durham. Learn.unh.edu. From the co-op food stores of Hanover, Lebanon, and White River Junction, working with 270 regional food producers and farmers to offer customers thousands of local foods. And the Courier Museum of Art in Manchester presenting Africa Interweave, colorful textiles from across the continent, opens Saturday. Details online at courier.org. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, preparing for the floods of the future, how communities are shoring up their defenses against increasingly frequent and severe weather events. We invite you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. What have you seen in your town? Do you live in a community that has experienced major flooding over the past decade? How was your town impacted? Could it have been better prepared? Did any positive changes come after the flood? Maybe things were rebuilt in a better way. Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And Jennifer Jacobs and Sherry Godlewski, I want to bring another voice into our conversation now. Perry Plummer is with us, Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management in New Hampshire. And Perry Plummer, thanks for your time. We really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
Well, as I understand, you just came back from a huge conference. You talked to the head of FEMA. officials from Colorado, which, as we all know, has struggled so much with flooding this month. What was everybody saying at this meeting, Mr. Plummer? What was the big theme everyone was talking about?
Yeah, it was actually a Homeland Security Advisors, State Homeland Security Advisors meeting in D.C., and it was for a couple of days. And you know, we talked to all of the head officials from FEMA, Craig Fugate, and from Homeland Security. And, you know, the talk is, you know, how do we make this better? Because the truth of the matter is, you know, 100-year floods continue to happen. You know, one of the rules that we had during other storms was FEMA looked at during their public assistance programs, when we got a presidential declaration, we're looking at replacing in kind, which is very much like an insurance policy where it says, if this was damaged and you had this happen, would they put it back to exactly the way it was and make you whole again? Well, the obviously, a lot of the conversation is now is how do we make it better than it was? Because, you know, obviously to fix something and then 5 years later have another flood and have it washed out again, which has happened in the state, is problematic. So the talk now is how do we get funds so we can do improvement and betterments so it doesn't happen again? You know, I sat in a meeting up in Westmoreland who was devastated by floods in this last disaster that we declared. And one of the residents said, that's great. You're going to put the road back the way that it was after it was washed out. It's been washed out twice in 7 years. What's going to stop it from washing out again? And we're going to be putting more money into it. So, you know, that is those are the discussions that are happening at the state level, the federal level, and I'm sure probably the local level as well. Is how do we make it better? How do we make it so that once we fix it, it's fixed and we can move on to another project?
So the earlier thinking at FEMA and in terms of flood disaster assistance was, okay, let's put it back together the way it was. Now you're saying officials in Washington and at the state level are saying, that's pointless because if you just rebuild it the way it was, it's going to get washed out again.
Right. And that, you know, that was the discussions. You know, I spent a long time as an emergency management director in a local community. And we had asked those questions years ago and said, okay, so if it's got an 8-inch culvert and that got washed out, can we go to a 12 or can we go to a type of box culvert or something? And there were, obviously it's not as simple as it sounds because there's money issues. There's environmental issues because it changes some of the flow of water and those type of things. And so the conventional thinking was, nope, if it was an 8-inch culvert before, you can replace it with just the same thing and move on. And that's great if you have a 100-year flood every 100 years.
Yeah, we were talking about that earlier.
That hasn't been the case. So now the thinking is, how do we make it so we improve what's there, oversize it to make sure that it can take some of these increased weather patterns, and that way it, you know, helps protect the public. It helps protect the environment better because it doesn't get washed out. And quite frankly, it allows us to use our dollars more wisely. And during a disaster, we don't have to deal with that one location again, so we can move on to a location that needs our help more, because obviously there's limited resources, and when there's when they have these multiple locations, it's really hard to juggle those resources. Less disaster locations, better help for the areas that have the disaster or have the that need the help.
So here at the state level, Mr. Plummer, what's the long-term planning on going right now here in New Hampshire for better flood preparation, community by community?
Yeah. So, you know, so obviously in the past, you know, disasters are reactionary somewhat. So, you know, obviously we have a weather pattern come through like we did not that long ago, and then we react to the damage and try to provide help. Our goal, you know, with the direction of Governor Hassan, has been to take a look at a long-term strategy. Where are we flooding on a regular basis, and what type of money are we putting into those areas, and is there a better strategy? For example, if you look at an area or a house that's been flooded, you know, four times in 15 years, and they've collected flood insurance, so flood federal flood money has gone into it. We've done, you know, we've given them some money. You know, the local communities put a match in, and you keep looking at those, and you say, there's been a lot of money spent for equal to or less money. Can we buy that property out, or can we change the culvert? Can we do something that long term that we're not going to keep doing, having to do this, and it's probably going to save us money in the long run? Our goal is to try to do that in advance. So the charge that the governor's asked us to do is look at a long-term mitigation program to look at where our most vulnerable areas are, what kind of money we put into them over the years, what kind of money do we anticipate putting in them, and is there a fix before it happens that would be more cost effective and cause less suffering from our citizens. And so we're in the process of working extremely hard on that. It's not an easy task, and we have 234 towns we have to look at. We have to look at a lot of data, a lot of anecdotal discussions with emergency management directors and communities about where they sustain their flooding.
Where they keep seeing the same problems again and again.
Exactly. And so we're in the process of that data gathering right now. Once we have all that and we know where our problems are, we can help do some predictions as to where we're going to have problems in the future and try to get ahead of that those storms and fix those. With that being said, you know, it's going to require some funding, so we're going to have to take a look at that once we get to that point.
Okay.
Just so you know, when we declare a disaster, and it's based on a public assistance disaster, which means help for municipalities, it's based on a per capita amount for each community has to qualify for a per capita level of damage, and then a state level of damage, and then FEMA, we can do a presidential declaration. We get that, then FEMA will provide us funds for 75%. It still puts 25% burden on the community,
which can be a lot given the levels of damage that we've seen.
It absolutely could. You know, we recently are up in Warren.
And Mr. Plummer, I have to wrap you up. I do apologize. I've got some other calls coming in. But boy, I have the feeling we'll be talking to you again soon, especially after the next flood, because we all know these are coming. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me on.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye-bye. That's Perry Plummer, Director of Homeland Security and Emergency Management in New Hampshire. And we'd love to hear from you this hour as well. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And before we go to our listeners, Sherry, did want to talk to you and also you, Jennifer. Maybe Jennifer, you first. This idea of we need a better strategy. We need to look at the data, look at where the problems are, and apply the resources there.
I thought Perry was spot on with what he was saying. And what we're trying to do right now is really catch up from where we were. So we were designing up until very recently based upon 1960s and past, earlier precipitation records. So really old data. And so New Hampshire is just recently using data that accounts from 2008 back in time. And so when he said we are going to oversize it, I would say we're going to right-size it. So we're not even talking about global climate change. We're talking about what's happened to us over the past 50 years and what do we need to do for design in order to make certain that we meet what we've seen in the past 50 years.
Okay, I'm stunned by what you just told me. We're working with 1960s data. I mean, the flooding has changed dramatically since then. The weather events have changed dramatically since the 60s.
Agreed. It's really amazing. But it takes a long time to move this forward. And this is the data that we've had to work with, to design with, that I've taught my students, my civil engineering students, how to do design work with up until about the past year or so.
Wow. Do you want to jump in there, Sherry?
Well, I agree with everything Jennifer said and what Mr. Plummer said, and I think that using new data is a great place to start. And we do have that. There's new data that's put out by Cornell, excuse me, and our agency is using it in some of our permitting programs as well, requiring folks to design based on these new data. And I also liked what I heard Mr. Plummer say in terms of federal FEMA looking at allocating funding to upsize.
Yeah, let's not just rebuild it the way it was.
That's really exciting because our communities have struggled with that. They know. The communities know their vulnerabilities. They live there. They see that, the repeated blowouts of culverts and roads. And so now that we know that there's federal dollars available to upsize, that is going to be so helpful for our communities. And communities in New Hampshire are required to have a hazard mitigation plan in order to receive FEMA money after an event. And in these hazard mitigation plans, that's where they can put forward those vulnerable areas in their community. So when it happens, it's in their plan and they can receive this federal funding.
Okay. I have a lot more questions for both of you, especially about this idea of, you know, zoning and permitting and where you're allowed to build and where you aren't, how things have changed. But let's go to our listeners as as well. The number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. And Roger's waiting in Stratham. Hi, Roger, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you, Laura. This June, the president came out with a climate action plan, and fully one-third of it talked about adaptation and the role of the federal government in assisting communities. So I'm interested in, and following Mr. Plummer's discussion, the different responsibilities of municipalities, local government, the state government, and the federal government in making these changes.
Yeah, so who's responsible, Roger? Is that what you're saying, for making these changes so that the adaptation is there? It seems to be what he's saying. Go ahead. Do you want to talk about that, Sherry?
Sure. Some responsibility is on the state in terms of our rules and our regulations, and then there are other responsibilities that are on the shoulders of the municipality. Municipalities are responsible for zoning regulations. They're responsible for floodplain widths or setbacks from water bodies. And so,
now, hang on, I'm sorry to jump in there, but I think I know what you mean, but everybody might not know what you mean by sort of floodplains and setbacks and so forth. So just explain that a little bit.
So when you think about a river corridor and you think you might want to live right next to that river because it's beautiful, there are needs environmentally to have setbacks because we're going to need a septic system. We're going to need things in order to run our household. And so there are certain setbacks required by state regulations.
So you can't live right on the river.
Right. To protect the water, but also now when we talk about what we're talking about here today, also to protect you. And some of those zoning regulations or those setback requirements are governed by the municipality. And so our job at the state is to work with the municipalities to help them understand the current data, the local flood projections, what's happening now, so that they can make informed decisions about how they want to zone locally. So it's important for community members to understand what is the responsibility of your municipality versus what is the state's responsibility. And we are working closely with our municipalities so that everyone understands what the current data is, what local data is available to them, them being the municipalities, the decision makers, so that we can have appropriate setbacks and zoning regulations to protect our public health.
Yeah, and protecting the people who live in those houses that might now get washed away. Maybe 50 years ago that wasn't so much a problem.
Correct.
I wonder how often local officials struggle with the desires of builders and homeowners, because certainly 50 years ago, 75 years ago, Sherry, houses were built right on the river. So some people might say, well, hey, Joe has his house right on the river. Why can't I have mine? So how do you answer Joe there?
Well, it's hard to answer Joe. And it's also another point that I thought Roger might be making, our caller, was that the flood insurance is changing. And so folks who live in flood-prone areas may not be able to protect their home at the rate that they are used to paying. So there are going to be huge increases in cost for folks living in flood-prone areas. And then there's also congressional legislation going on right now that may even require them not to be able to get money to rebuild. And so those are conversations that are very, very hard for folks, because it's expensive if you're going to be in a flood-prone area, even if you are able to get insurance to stay in that flood-prone area.
Well, and that's a whole topic, and we could do a whole hour on that. And Jennifer, I want to get you in too. But Sherry, people have been saying for a while now, at least the past decade, the flood insurance system as we know it now isn't working. You know, taxpayers are paying too much for people to rebuild, you know, half a dozen times. On the other hand, for people in those areas, if they don't have, you know, the price of flood insurance could get out of control and they would have to move. Is the change really happening, or are we just talking about it more?
Well, we're talking about it more, and it is really happening, because these repeated losses that Mr. Plummer referred to, if a house continues to get inundated with water and just put right back there, there's things that have to change there. And so in some communities, they require the homeowner to build up so that they have a higher base flood elevation, and also suggesting that people living in these houses don't put any of their utilities. We're used to having our, you know, all our electric system in the basement, our washer, our dryer, but put all that up higher so that should a flood come through, that's sort of a blowout area of your house, that it could get flooded out, but none of your home infrastructure, your electric, your plumbing, all that, none of that would get blown out because that would be elevated at a safer level.
Interesting. I'd love to hear from you too, Jennifer, on this idea that we're having to rethink permitting, zoning, and this controversial flood insurance program that we currently have?
Well, I think everything Sherry said is right on. And I think the other challenge that we're getting into is we've got information that is coming out of the climate community or out of the hydrology community on where's the water, when's the water coming, how much is it going to be, and where's it going to be. But when we talk about building, we have an entire infrastructure on bridges and roads. And so we need to figure out a way to accelerate our translation of that information that on precipitation, where the water is, so that it is coming to the bridge and the road community in a meaningful way so that they can make smart decisions. And I don't think we're there quite yet. In the past, you heard me say 1960 data, we had some time to be able to respond to that. And I think what we've seen over the past decade is we don't have that luxury of time. Every year that passes, we have more infrastructure, more requests for federal dollars, and more costs that are on the community in response to disaster. So I think taking all that information and making it digestible for whether it is the State Department of Transportation or whether it is this local DPWs so that they can act on the information is a really critical thing to do right now.
How do you think communities might look different, Jennifer, if they were built on the data we have now instead of, you know, 1960s data? For example, you know, in Concord, the Contoocook River, there are houses right on that river. And it's lovely if you live there. For example, again, in Concord, this is the town I know best, obviously, our major shopping centers are right on the Merrimack River, all the grocery stores and other stores and so forth. I mean, would we do that if we were starting Concord from scratch? Or would we say, no way, you know, you're right on these rivers and they're going to get flooded?
Well, as much as I like water, it's not all about the water. And certainly New Hampshire has a long history of all the mills that were developed. So there's a good reason why we're developed right along the water.
Transportation back in the day, right. And then mill right. Power for the, electricity for the mills.
Along the rivers, that's usually an easy place to put in roads. If we start getting into areas with granite, lots of blasting, lots of hills, we've got some other challenges. So going back in time, it's really a challenge. We would like to set back from the rivers, but the reality is that if you start having quite a large setback, that the land that we can develop is really quite limited. So we will have that conflict.
Yes, because we have miles and miles and miles of rivers, streams, lakes, ponds, and they're beautiful, but it's tricky building mm-hmm. in and around them. All right, well, a couple emails coming in, so I want to share those with you after a short break. And we'll take your calls to 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page, NHPR Exchange. A lot more coming up.
This is NHPR 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, the partisan divide over food stamps and then a Colombian novelist on his country's brutal drug wars. All coming up on the Diane Rehm Show.
The Diane Rehm Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Heritage Plumbing Heating Cooling. For any plumbing, heating, cooling, or drain problem, offering annual tune-ups and efficient heating systems, online at justcallheritage.com. And R.M. Davis Incorporated, celebrating 35 years of providing investment counsel, wealth management, and trust services with offices in Portland and Portsmouth, online at rmdavis.com. New Hampshire weather mostly sunny for most of the state. It'll start out cloudy with an isolated shower from Coos County, then turning partly sunny there. Windy statewide. Highs today, lower 50s from the mountains north, ranging upper 50s, lower 60s for the rest of the state. Then mostly clear tonight, lows tonight in the 30s. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we talk with Dartmouth professor and popular author Charles Whelan about his book, Naked Economics. Find us on Facebook at NHPR Exchange to join the conversation ahead of the show, and then join us tomorrow morning live at 9. Today in The Exchange, the rise in floods in New Hampshire. We're looking at how communities are starting to adapt to more frequent and more damaging storms. The number for you to join us is 1-800-892-6477. Has your town suffered from severe flooding in recent years? How, perhaps, could your community have been better prepared? Did any positive changes come out of the flood after the fact? 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. nhpr.org. Here's a couple emails and Facebook comments that have come in. And Jason posted a comment on our Facebook page. He says, I remember interning at NHPR during the Mother's Day floods in 2006. Jason, I remember you. It's good to hear from you. Learning about how insurance companies define what is a flood and how the floods had affected the state was crazy. I don't think we'll have time to get into that whole issue, folks, of insurance companies and how they deal with floods. But he's right. You may consider your house completely flooded and the insurance company may think, that's not necessarily a flood. Either of you want to comment on how insurance and individual homeowners deal with this, or Sherry?
Yeah, Laura, I'll just make a comment. And I think what's interesting about Jason's post is that with climate change, we're talking to people we never talked to before. Like in my environmental career, I never worked with the insurance industry. I didn't really work with public health or emergency management. And now these are the types of conversations we're having all around, because this changes in our precipitation impacts all of us. And we need to learn more about the insurance industry and how they perceive things. We need to talk with more people like Jennifer and learn how roads are structured in relation to precipitation. And so while I can't answer that question very intelligently, I can say it is a really good question. And we are actively trying to learn more about how insurance companies, private insurance companies, perceive these issues.
Yeah. And Jason, that's probably a whole nother program, because you're right. There are a lot of issues there. But thanks for the comment. Here's an email from Barbara. She says, I hear officials in nearby towns talk about the need to install larger culverts for these larger storms. Barbara asks, won't this lead to a larger downstream effect? Is this really a good approach? What about keeping stormwater closer to where it falls so the storm surges are reduced? Barbara also asks, what about stormwater utilities? Our stormwater infrastructure seems to be underfunded and given less attention than other infrastructure. By the way, Barbara's in Aetna. Thanks, Barbara, for that email. Couple good questions there. Let's talk about the stormwater infrastructure first. Jennifer Jacobs, is it up to the task?
Well, the stormwater infrastructure has really been developing over the past year. And the point that she made about the underfunding, it's a challenge because unlike wastewater and drinking water, where there's a treatment plant that you can specifically fund, the stormwater is challenged because it's diffused all over the region. So the point that she made about, can't we just put this stuff back in the ground? Well, we can do a better job of trying to get it back in the ground. And when you mentioned pervious pavement earlier, certainly that's one method. And so retaining the water that's coming off of areas that are new developments is an important approach. But still, we're going to have some water that's coming through. Even if that area isn't developed, we're seeing more water. And so we do need to work on making the culverts larger. A lot of the challenges that we bump into are not problems because the stream itself is not able to carry the water. We end up having backup of water behind a roadway where there's a culvert. And so the water starts washing over the roadway and erodes the roadway. And that's where we're seeing some of the major problems.
And that was the big problem in Alstead, right?
That was the problem.
The culvert burst. And
that was the problem in Alstead. That's a problem in Colorado. That's the problem in some of the areas in the White Mountains when Irene went through. Vermont certainly suffered from that. Lots of small rivers going through culverts, or small streams going through culverts, that really weren't sized to handle them.
Interesting. All right, Barbara, thanks a lot for the comments. And I want to go now to Lebanon. Mike Lavalla is there. He's Director of Public Works in Lebanon. And as we talked earlier in the program, a town that suffered a lot earlier this summer from a dramatic downpour. Mike Lavalla, thanks a lot for being with us.
Oh, good morning. Thank you for having me on.
Well, as I understand, you've been in that position for about a decade. What have you seen in terms of the intensity of the rainstorms, Mike?
Intensity-wise, and just anecdotally from my perspective, but also I think from the data we've seen, recently the storms have become more intense. Duration-wise, of the intensity, I think, has increased. We seem to be getting fewer and fewer storms where typically you'd have a rainstorm, a gentle storm for a protracted period of time. Now we seem to be getting very, very intense storms, maybe not for a protracted time, but the intensity is what is causing a lot of our damage.
And that's what I understand was the problem on July 2nd, right, Mike? What did that look like, that July 2nd downpour?
Right, that's correct. Just to set the plate for it a little, June, July of this year we had nearly triple the amount of rain in this area. So the soils were already saturated when we first had an inch and a half of rain on July 1st, and then over 3.5 inches of rain on the 2nd.
Wow, so it's a lot all at once.
Yeah, so what happened with a number of the existing culverts were overtopped, meaning that they just could not handle the volume of water that was coming over. So either they became plugged with debris, water came over, across the roads, washed out drainage ditches, washed out roadsides. We had in Lebanon probably about 61 roads which were impacted, probably close to 200 individual sites, the worst being Slayton Hill Road. It 2.5 miles of road was damaged during that storm.
Wow. So you had nearly the triple the amount of rain you normally have in June and July. And then, as you said, once that downpour came, that was just enough. The ground couldn't take it anymore. What a little bit more about infrastructure, if you could, Mike. You mentioned the culverts, not big enough, couldn't withstand these sudden surges. Were there other pieces of infrastructure that could have been bigger or stronger and therefore able to better withstand the volume of water that you were seeing?
In our case, it was more a function of the culverts being inundated and overtopped. Once they did, just the volume and velocity of the flow of water washed out a number of drainage ditches, washed into shoulders. The culverts themselves, even though there may have been appropriate sizing on some of the culverts, with the volume of rain and velocity, once it did pick up some debris, the culverts were easily plugged and overtopped.
So what are you going to do differently now that you're rebuilding in Lebanon, these damaged areas? What are you going to do differently than before?
Well, before, typically, we were sizing structures for a 25-year storm on a lot of our rural local roads. In some areas, we were looking at 50-year storms. We are now beginning, especially with the Slayton Hill reconstruction, looking at designing for a 100-year storm. Again, we'll have sizing that will be a little bit larger than what typically would be in place, but given what we have seen for rainfall and having a prudent plan in place to protect our infrastructure, we're going to be looking to designing to those standards.
Okay. Mike Lavalla, good to talk to you, and good luck.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay. That's Mike Lavalla, Director of Public Works for the City of Lebanon, which, as we heard, was really hard hit earlier this summer. And I'm sure both of you, Jennifer Jacobs and Sherry Godlewski, were at least reading about what happened in Lebanon. What's the takeaway, Sherry, for you from what happened there? There were some neighborhoods that were just devastated. And it seems like culverts, once again, were part of the problem.
Right. Yes, Laura, you know, culverts were part of the problem. But I think, as Jennifer touched on earlier, it's not just upsizing of culverts that are going to solve our problems. Yes, we have to upsize our culverts, but we also have to do more infiltration in place so that when we have these big runoff events, it can infiltrate as well. Because in Barbara's concern with her email is if we just put bigger culverts in, the community downstream from Lebanon is just going to get all that water. So it's a combination of approaches that need to be utilized. And the bad news about Lebanon's event was the soil was so saturated that it was just a difficult thing. And I think this is why we need to continue these conversations and looking at more local data, more recent data, accurate data, to know what we can anticipate so we can have infrastructure in place, such as culverts, as well as infiltration for when the soil isn't it's not always going to be saturated. So
infiltration means sort
meaning
of.
You know, low impact development. So we're having rain gardens. Folks at home are using rain barrels on their homes to catch the runoff off their roof. All of this helps the amount of water going through a system to be decreased. And so we need to work in our neighborhoods as well as with our municipalities so that we are all thinking about this and managing it collectively.
Well, and that's a really interesting point that you made. And so, Jennifer, to you, you know, we have focused a lot this hour about municipal infrastructure, cities and towns, bridges, culverts, roads. But what about individuals? Sherry was starting to touch on that, and I'd like to hear from you, too.
Well, I think the individuals have a way to make an impact by, one, talking to the communities and making certain that the communities recognize that this is an important and a critical issue, because municipal officials have a lot of different concerns on their plates. And so, again, you said earlier, the flood happens, it goes away, and we don't think about it. And so making certain that we are thinking ahead, that we're managing for the next event.
We meaning the individual homeowner.
We meaning the individual homeowner. But I also think that we need to start thinking about more than just upsizing the culverts, that we need to be a little bit more innovative in how we're tackling some of these problems. For bridges, when you talk about a bridge collapse, one of the things that happens is that there's a lot of scour around a pier, meaning that the soil that was holding that pier in place can go away. If it goes away, that bridge doesn't have the support. So one of the things that we can be thinking about as we're replacing our bridges is getting those piers out of the water, so not even having to deal with the scour issue or the potential for collapse, but supporting the ability for the bridge engineers to do their job right.
So building bridges in a different way.
Building bridges in a different way. And same thing when we talk about roads, that if we have roads that maybe some of those along the rivers that are being repeatedly flooded, maybe we need to think about moving those and letting the river move and letting the streams move where they're going to move anyway.
Wow, that's a controversial issue. You know, if you've got a house next to the road, what do you do with the house? If you've got a business next to the road, I'm thinking of Route 3 right next to the Merrimack River. There are a lot of businesses on the non-river side of that road.
We've got to start thinking innovatively. Not all the innovative thinking is going to lead to a solution, but if we do things piecemeal, one culvert at a time, we're probably not addressing the problem at the scale we need to be addressing it at.
Let's take another call. This is Roger in Hillsboro. Hi, Roger, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, I do live in Hillsboro, and in Hillsboro we have a number of historic stone arch bridges. And in fact, a number of years ago, one of them in particular sustained a lot of damage in two of the different, you know, back-to-back 100-year storms. And, you know, living in New Hampshire, I imagine that, you know, we have a great deal of historic, you know, locations all over the state. And I was just wondering if there was any plan, you know, that the state is looking at to try to protect our historic heritage. You know, we can't really address stone arch bridges with setbacks or moving them or whatever. So is there something we can do about that?
No, Roger, thank you very much. And, you know, they're part of our landscape. They're part of what makes New Hampshire unique. We all like to see them as we go by. What do you think? This is a tough one, Sherry.
Well, I agree with Roger. I think it is it's a part of our cultural heritage to have these stone arch bridges, as well as downtown Portsmouth, for instance. There's a number of historic buildings right on the waterfront, and we talk about inland flooding, but we can't forget sea level rise and storm surge. And each of these communities, probably every community in New Hampshire, has some historical resource that is of concern right now. And our Department of Environmental Services is working with DOT to talk about these issues, and we have to think innovatively, as Jennifer has said, and we also have to do things on a case-by-case basis, because individuals in the communities know what is going on. So if we can work with our communities, obtain local scientific data so we can better understand what might happen, then we can come up with a plan for how we're going to address these. But it is challenging, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, you could rebuild it so that it's perfect and hardly ever faces any threat, but it wouldn't be the same bridge. So that's tricky. Thank you very much, Roger, for calling. Here's an email from Sean in Littleton. He says, much of the flood damage resulting from the recent flooding can be attributed to past alterations of our streams and rivers Many of these alterations occurred decades or even over a century ago. As an example, many rivers were dredged and straightened for more efficient log drives or for flood control. These altered streams are more sensitive and prone to erosion during extreme floods. Sean says we are now dealing with the repercussions of these historic land use decisions. Future stream and river management decisions should be made with the knowledge of their long-term consequences. This is a really interesting point and one that I had not thought about. He's right, Jennifer. Some of these rivers were straightened so that you could rush the logs down them. And then in an extreme weather event, it's easier for the water to rush down.
Absolutely. And that was part of the early engineering design, which was keep the water separate from where the people are. And what we've learned is that that's great for these lower floods, but for the larger floods, the river's going to do what it wants to do. One great example from the Mother's Day flood is the Suncook River. And I drove over it as I went by Route 4 in Epson, and that river just jumped its channel and made an entirely new channel. So, and that river is still continuing to evolve and to move back upstream. And so we need to recognize that the rivers and the geomorphology or the what's underneath them is going to allow those rivers to change. And we can put in concrete structures, we can put in riprap or large rocks to try to control that. But we've got a delicate balance there.
Yeah, and I remember when the Suncook River literally jumped its banks and people in that area said, we didn't even know rivers could do that. So we're dealing with a whole new world here. I want to thank both of you very much for coming in. I appreciate it. And the next time there's a flood, we'll be talking to you. Thank you very much for coming in, Sherry. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Laura. It was nice.
Sherry Godlewski, Environmental Program Manager for the New Hampshire Department of Environmental Services. Jennifer Jacobs, good to meet you. Thank you for being here.
Pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Jennifer Jacobs, Professor of Civil Engineering at UNH with a specialty in water. She's also Director of the Infrastructure and Climate Network. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producers are Ellen Grimm and Faith Meixel. Our volunteers are Priscilla Malcolm, John Barrett, and Alan Cohen. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, Dartmouth professor Charles Whelan on his best-selling book, Naked Economics, Undressing the Dismal Science. Whelan presents the basics like supply and demand, but also explains the principles behind the major economic debates of our time, including Federal Reserve policy, the government's response to recession, and trade and globalization. Send us your thoughts by email, Facebook, and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show next at 10 on NHPR, where support comes from UR members and from Comcast Business, partnering with businesses of any size to provide scalable technology solutions that keep pace with growth and success. More at business.comcast.com. And Bellamy Fields Assisted Living in Dover. More information on geriatrics with a sense of humor online at bellamyfields.com.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO Concord, 89.1.
WEVS Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN Keene, 90.7.
WEVC Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
Good morning, it's 10 o'clock.
From WAMU and NPR in Washington, I'm Steve Roberts of the George Washington University, sitting in today for Diane Rehm. In the past decade, as the country has gone through the recession and high unemployment, the number of people on food stamps has doubled. Today, 1 in 7 Americans qualify for the federal benefit. The government now spends nearly $80 billion on food stamps, and many Republicans in Congress want that cost.